Whatever moisture's on the ground as you go to bed tonight will be frozen solid long before you get up. What's more, the National Weather Service says it's going to happen quickly and likely create very dangerous driving conditions tonight and tomorrow morning. Meteorologist Dan Zumpf says cold air and snow from the Pacific Ocean passed through most of the region earlier today, but a system moving down from the Canadian interior will have far bigger implications on our entire listening area.
We've been cold, but not very cold for this time of year thus far this winter, and this system's really going to change things. What we're going to see is temperatures fall below zero in a lot of places. Of course, Butte every winter we see 20 below zero, but we're seeing that potential with this storm. Also, as the ground and the roads have been wet from recent rains and the snow today, we're afraid that this evening people are going to be caught off guard by flash freezes. The winds will be coming through places like Hellgate Canyon near Missoula and Bad Rock Canyon up on Highway 2 near Kalispell, and we're really concerned that people will be traveling and they won't notice that the road has turned wet to ice. And so we're really trying to get the message out there to have people be safe about that.
Zump says tomorrow morning's commute will almost certainly be dangerous.
And especially people that are commuting between towns, like people that would commute between Hamilton and Missoula, 93, I think overnight tonight is just going to be awful. But that's not the only roadway. I'm pretty much talking about most of the roadways in western Montana having some kind of sudden icing effect that's going to really slow people down tomorrow morning. And we hope that they'll take an extra time and be safe in this condition.
Zump's advice, if you don't have to be on the roads tomorrow morning, stay home. He says this will be the coldest weather to move through the region in at least 3 years. While those temperatures are the real headline of this system, the outgoing Pacific cold front dropped some badly needed snow in the higher elevations.
We've seen some of the snowpack in the Bitterroot Mountain Range, for example, almost double with the storm so far. So really most of the snow that we were measuring way up high in Glacier Park Mountains and in the Bitterroot Range, that snow is probably going to be ending here this evening for the most part. And it's been pretty impressive.
The city of Missoula's street maintenance supervisor, Brian Hensel, reminds everyone to get back in the winter driving frame of mind as we contend with what could be the first black ice event of the year. Hensel adds his street maintenance crew is ready to go at a moment's notice should they get the go-ahead from the police department.
We have different options available. We have the liquid magnesium chloride that is effective more often on probably 15 above temperatures, and then we have a granular de-icer that is more effective below that temperature. And then as a last ditch, we also have the ability to use sand if we need to down in the flat areas of town. But that's kind of a last option because when we're done, we have to be concerned with air quality and we have to try and get that sand swept up as soon as possible.
Those street crews follow a strictly adhered to priority list.
We concentrate first on the main streets through town that get the most traffic. For example, Reserve is one of them. Brooks, Higgins, Russell. Fairly easy to figure out those streets which you get stuck in the traffic for the longest time. Those are the ones we go to first. When we get all those done, then we go to the priority twos, which would have lesser traffic volumes, but also may include bus routes, those streets that may have steeper grades, winding corners, things of that nature. And then so on, the threes, and then finally the last thing that we get to are the low-volume residentials.
Hensel has 22 crew members at his disposal who can operate 14 plow trucks equipped with blades, de-icers, and sanders, and an additional 4 graders are available for the really heavy snowfall events. More on weather is coming up later in this broadcast.
And in other news from around the state, authorities say heavy snow and poor visibility are hampering the search for a small airplane that disappeared in the central Idaho backcountry. The Valley County Sheriff's Department launched a search today for a single-engine Beech Bonanza that went missing yesterday afternoon. 5 people, all from the same family, were on board. Lieutenant Dan Smith says more than 20 people are combing the mountain ridge near the Johnson Creek airstrip, a backcountry landing strip near the tiny town of Yellow Pine. Smith says heavy snow was so far foiled the efforts to search by air. The plane was flying to Butte when it lost radio contact with controllers.
The Montana Highway Patrol says a woman in a 5-vehicle crash has died near Great Falls as snow and ice are creating those hazardous driving conditions across the state. The Great Falls Tribune reports the unidentified woman died as a result of the crash just east of Manchester during this afternoon's snowstorm. The Highway Patrol says the crash is under investigation and no other details are immediately available.
Police in Missoula have made two more arrests in connection with an undercover drug investigation in which a police officer was shot and injured. Police spokesman Scott Pastian says 31-year-old Rochelle Joe Colden was arrested yesterday and 31-year-old Justin Michael Holds the Enemy was arrested today. The undercover police officer and Joshua Lee Robinson were shot during what officers described as a, quote, drug rip, end quote, robbery last Wednesday in Missoula. Robinson is charged with attempted deliberate homicide and robbery for allegedly trying to take the money the officer had to buy methamphetamine. Jasmine Severina Beeler is charged with conspiracy to commit robbery and criminal distribution of dangerous drugs for an alleged November 14th meth sale. Jail records indicate Colton and Holds the Enemy face robbery and drug charges.
The Missoula County Sheriff's Office is looking for a man who robbed an East Missoula convenience store at knife point. Sheriff Sergeant Anthony Rio tells the Missoulian the suspect entered the Quick Stop at about 10:15 a.m. this morning and forced the clerk to hand over money from the cash register. The clerk said the man pointed the knife at the back of his neck and forced him into a walk-in freezer. Sheriff spokeswoman Paige Pavillon says the clerk stayed in the freezer until he heard the bell ring on the store's door. The suspect is described as a white man about 5 feet 10 inches tall and weighing 220 pounds. He had brown eyes. The man was dressed all in black and had a ski mask over his face.
Montana's chief public defender says money from the state legislature this year is improving working conditions for public defense attorneys. But Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says the office is still looking for more help.
Public defenders represent people in court who cannot afford their own attorney, and it's all at the state's expense. Montana took over control of public defender responsibilities in 2006. Before that, it was handled by counties. The state public defender's office has had workload problems from the beginning. Individual attorneys sometimes have hundreds of active cases at the same time, making less than they would for a lower caseload in the private sector. Chief Public Defender Bill Hooks says his office has a system for determining an attorney's workload. It takes into account the number of cases they're working and the type of cases. He says there's a point which qualifies as being overworked.
And typically, most, if not all, of our attorneys are at or near that point on any given day.
And that's after help from the 2013 legislature. Lawmakers gave the body over $1 million for employee raises. Hook says that has helped.
We were able to bring our attorney salaries more in line with what our colleagues were getting in other courts throughout the state. So I think that that was a significant improvement, and we're very appreciative of that.
The legislature also set aside some cash to pay for private contract attorneys. The public defender's office uses them in certain regions where there aren't enough full-time attorneys to represent everyone. And lawmakers also set aside money for 8 new full-time positions. The office used that money to make some temporary part-time positions permanent. But Governor Steve Bullock's office originally requested 37 new positions. Again, Chief Public Defender Bill Hooks.
We believe then and now that that was a number that would accurately reflect what we need.
The number of cases continues to rise, especially since Montana's office deals with types of cases Hook says are non-traditional cases for public defenders, civil cases like dependent neglect cases, youth court cases, guardianship disputes.
We either need to halt the case increases or bolster our ability to meet that increase with people.
Hooks is working on both of those goals right now. A Helena judge recently denied the office's request for the authority to stop accepting cases until the office could get caught up. The public defender's office is appealing that decision. Hooks also says the office will be asking for staffing help again from the legislature in 2015. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
Nearly 600 Montanans are living with HIV or AIDS. The State Department of Public Health says that figure is relatively low, but still too high. Montana recognized World AIDS Day today with a ceremony in the state capitol building. Governor Steve Bullock spoke to the gathering, saying scientific advances and new treatment options are turning the tide in the fight against HIV and AIDS worldwide. But infection rates are not going down in the U.S. or in Montana. Bullock says public awareness has reached a state of HIV fatigue.
The disease is over 30 years old, and it can be all too easy for us to become complacent. perhaps particularly among younger generations who didn't witness the ravages of the 80s and 90s.
The reception honored five people who help improve the lives of HIV and AIDS infected Montanans. Recipient Greg Smith works as executive director of AIDS Outreach, a Bozeman organization providing HIV testing, service, and support. Smith faults state lawmakers for not providing more financial resources to help prevent HIV and AIDS in Montana. He says he came out as a HIV-positive gay man to show there should be no shame in the disease.
A virus. A microscopic being that happens to live inside my body. I would like to keep it from living in anybody else's. And so do you, I hope.
The state health department says more than 400 Montanans have died of AIDS since 1985. Other award recipients today include Missoula Community Outreach and Prevention Specialist Stephanie Cole, Missoula HIV Outreach Worker Christopher Gehring, Missoula Coordinator of the Empowerment MT Gay Men's Task Force Chance Tilmoney, and Helena Bodywork Therapist Lisa Fairman.
With more information than ever before at our fingertips, you would think the American consumer's news literacy or knowledge of current events had never been higher. The fact is that literacy is slipping dramatically. University of Montana radio television professor Ray Fanning teaches a class on news literacy. In this feature interview, he talks with news director Sally Mock about how to become a smarter news consumer and about why our news literacy is declining.
I think it's that flood of information that we all have to deal with every day, that as ways of getting information has increased, you know, we just have to shut some of it out. And, you know, we become responsible for what we let in, and we may not be letting, you know, all of the right things in. And I think that leads to being, you know, not as well informed as we might want to be.
Recent Pew Research Center report showed that millennials, and those are defined as 18 to 31-year-olds, consume only about half as much news as people 48 and older.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to bode well for people who produce news. I think social media has taken over a lot of millennials' interest. That's really where they get the news is from their friends.
Facebook and Twitter.
Right, and less from, you know, traditional news sources where people have gone in the past. And then you get into the whole question of, you know, what sort of information are they getting, you know, from their friends and family.
Because I think the conventional wisdom among a lot of news organizations is that millennials are getting news, but they're getting it online versus traditional media from television, not so much, newspaper, print editions, not so much. But actually, the Pew report, what was interesting is that only 8% of millennials use their mobile devices to access newspapers. They're not using online to go to news sites.
Right, not to traditional, you know, news sites. I think they're finding, you know, their own way to discover news. I mean, it used to be that you had the newspaper in the morning and you could go there. You had the, you know, radio reports, you know, maybe on the hour. You had the local television reports, you know, for maybe a half an hour in the afternoon, and you knew, you know, where to go to get news. Now it's hard to decide, and you have to just sort of pick and find your own way, and I think that's opened up you know, the places that particularly millennials go to look for information.
Usually do this poll with many students. I say, where do you get your news? And the vast majority of them tell me from the Daily Show,
right?
Which
yeah.
is not a news organization by any stretch.
Right, exactly. I mean, I think John Stewart has talked about, you know, when he gets asked that question, are you a journalist, which he does get asked from time to time, what he says is that he comes the closest to maybe being an editorial cartoonist. But you
wonder. Big difference.
Yeah, exactly. So you wonder, though, if people are watching The Daily Show for news, do they know enough about the news to get the jokes? You know, that's what I always wonder. But, you know, it's there's a lot of news in there, but it's certainly the take on it is satirical and as he describes it, is more of a, you know, an editorial cartoon.
As you said earlier, the gatekeepers are gone.
Right.
Tell me more what you mean by that.
Well, it's, you know, in a traditional journalism situation, you have editors, you have producers, you know, reporters go out, they gather information, they come back and they bring it to a producer or to an editor who goes through their information and asks questions about it and vets it, you know, to the best of their ability before it gets to the public. And what's happened with the internet is, you know, on there are internet sites where news sites where there are gatekeepers, but basically it's the Wild West on the internet. You know, anybody with an opinion, whether it's based on fact or not, can get it out there where people can find it. So there's no one, you know, looking over, you know, so and so's blog and saying, really, you know, is that true? How do you prove that? Can you back that up?
So what's the news consumer to do to be their own gatekeeper? How can they decide and discern what sites are reliable in terms of fact and what sites are reliable in terms of informed analysis?
Yeah, it's tough, and this information age, this explosion of information, particularly on the internet, has put a lot of pressure on the consumer to do that. I mean, with websites, you want to look at who's behind, you know, the site to begin with. That's the first thing you want to check.
And do they have an agenda?
Yes, exactly. I mean, if you one of the things I show in my class is if you Google Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., you'll come up with a website around fourth or fifth on Google that's run by a pro-white organization, but it's
a white supremacist group,
but masquerading as a site about, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. Unless you look at it carefully, you go to, you know, who runs this site, you know, you may not know that you're getting information that does come with an agenda. So, you know, for websites, I say you got to find out who's behind it to begin with. Look to see if the information has been updated. You know, is it current? Is it filled with sort of hyperbole, that speaks to having an agenda? And then I would avoid that. I mean, Wikipedia is a problem because
is vetted.
Right. Some sites, they have now, you know, they lock down and they do vet.
They might put a little disclaimer on the site.
Right, exactly, yeah. that this information is in dispute. But if you go to Wikipedia thinking that you're getting something that's been vetted and gone through a gatekeeping process, you're not. So, you know, Wikipedia may be a place you can start to do research, but it certainly shouldn't be where you end.
In terms of where people go, we're all prone to do this, I suppose, which is we go to sites that will confirm what we already believe.
Right. I teach this news literacy class in the spring, and one of the things we recommend to students is that they avoid, they call this cognitive dissonance, and it's this trait in humans to seek out information that does confirm your own beliefs. So, you know, the recommendation there is that you got to go to sites that challenge your beliefs, at least some of the time, to sort of hear the other side of it. I mean, if you listen to Rush Limbaugh every day, you might want to seek out some other information from time to time to sort of balance that. And just the idea that you become aware of this, that people do have a tendency to you know, seek out that information that confirms what I already know, what I already believe, and then that just, you know, reinforces that belief. So you kind of have to do an inventory of your beliefs and maybe biases and kind of look at your news menu and think of ways to broaden it, you know, to try to counteract that.
Diversity of sites and so on.
Absolutely,
right.
Yeah.
How much responsibility, Ray, do you think news organizations bear for this confusion? And I ask that because it seems to me more and more news organizations have drifted away from objectivity into opinion.
Yeah, and there's some debate over whether objectivity is even possible. You know, now...
Well, even balance.
Right, right, exactly. But fairness and balance, certainly. You know, you look at like cable news, for instance. You know, you could go back and talk about how when CNN began in 82 or 3 or somewhere along in there, they created this 24-hour news cycle, and suddenly news organizations had 24 hours to fill. And that's tough without sort of straying away from the traditional news. And so I think news stations have moved in that direction also because of ratings. They have to make money. And if you put on, you know, what is basically entertainment news and it does well for you, you're going to put on more entertainment news. The other blurring of the lines, I think, is between what you mentioned, you know, fact-based reporting and opinion. And often, particularly on the cable sort of stations, you get them mixed in together. So it's not
very hard for the consumer to discern.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what we ask, you know, consumers to do in this course is look for those labels. You know, if someone is giving an opinion, it should be labeled as such.
Editorial or commentary.
Right.
Or,
exactly. Yeah. So that you know that the talking head you're listening to, you know, is giving his or her opinion. You know, we kind of use the term license to kill, like the James Bond title.
Yeah.
Yeah, motivation that special agents are given this license to kill. Well, some journalists are given a license to express their opinion. But where the news stations, I think, tend to fall down sometimes is they don't label it. They don't make it clear what's opinion and what's not. I mean, if you go to the New York Times website, you'll see that things are labeled as opinion. Or editorial, and they're in their own section. But a lot of times, you know, that's not true in other outlets, and there are other besides the New York Times mm-hmm. that do that. But on cable television, you know, you could have the same person, you know, reading a fact-based news story and then shifting into expressing their opinion. And it's really hard to tell and to know the difference.
And some of the journalists who, for example, might be on a mainstream station, so-called NBC or CBS, then they will turn up on MSNBC, which is much more of an opinion-oriented station.
Right.
And it's very hard for the viewer if they see Andrea Mitchell on the evening newscast and then on Rachel Maddow
right.
to know what is factual and what is her opinion.
Yeah, what role is that reporter playing now? Are they on an opinion show where they're speaking, you know, for themselves and what they believe? Or are they in the role of reporter where you've seen them in another, you know, situation talking about going out and getting information and presenting it in that manner? It's very difficult mm-hmm. for the consumers. So much responsibility is placed on the consumer in the way the news business operates these days.
What is the price we pay, Ray, if it's true that news literacy is declining in this country in terms of both consumption of news, like if millennials really aren't interested in news as much as their elders were? What's the price we're going to pay for that, do you think?
Well, I think what we're losing is the ability to be participating, engaged citizens. I mean, it comes down to voting. I mean, that's our chief responsibility as citizens is to participate in the government. I mean, I like to stress in this class that the First Amendment, in my opinion anyway, doesn't really refer to the institutional press, but it refers to the people, that the people have the right of the press, and that you need to exercise that and be informed so that you can make decisions. There's an example that I use, a University of Maryland study in the 2010 midterm election, asked voters a series of questions, things like, you know, have your taxes gone up or down or stayed the same since President Obama was elected in 2008? And, you know, a huge amount of people didn't know, you know, got that question wrong because, you know, they've either listened to things or they just have made up their own opinion, but they didn't know the real facts. And so I think we're paying the price of having the electorate be misinformed a lot when you go to cast your ballots.
It's not overstating to say that really democracy depends on an informed
I think it
citizenry.
Does. Yeah, and I think that's why it's important that as a journalism school, we educate practitioners who are going to go out and do journalism. But this news literacy movement is the idea that we also have a responsibility to educate news consumers so that they know what to expect and why it's important that they stay, you know, informed.
Well, I've been speaking with Ray Fanning, who teaches radio television in the Journalism School at the University of Montana, and we've been talking about news literacy. Ray, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Sally. Thank you.
UM Professor Ray Fanning will give a free public lecture on news literacy tomorrow evening at 6 o'clock in the North Ballroom of the University Center on the UM campus.
Now for tonight's forecast. As we reported earlier, there is a winter storm warning in effect until 1 a.m. Wednesday for our entire listening area, and that's for snow, blowing snow, and strong winds. And there is also a serious possibility for flash freezing tonight and into the morning tomorrow, making the morning commute dangerous. What's the divide tonight should be snow is likely with blowing snow and lows 7 to 14 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and highs 12 to 19 degrees. Wind gusts could reach up to 55 miles per hour. Central Montana tonight, expect snow with some areas of blowing snow and lows 0 to 10 degrees above zero. Wind gusts could be up to 45 miles per hour. Tomorrow, expect snow, areas of blowing snow and highs 5 to 10 degrees. And in southwest Montana tonight, expect snow with lows 0 to 5 degrees above. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy. Snow is likely and highs should be 5 to 10 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Tom Power.
Last October, Tea Party activists held a federal government hostage, shutting down a good chunk of the federal government and threatening to force the U.S. Treasury to default on federal bonds. In response, our political parties demonstrated their political courage by temporarily delaying that manufactured financial crisis, simply kicking the can down the road a couple of months. Come this January and February, the Tea Party and right-wing allies in the Republican Party again plan to take the federal government hostage to force their minority agenda on the rest of us. This economic blackmail by a minority Republican right wing is possible only because of false and misleading assertions about the supposed dangers associated with the federal deficit. It is worth reviewing these again, since after New Year's, we will be plunged into deja vu all over again, a cruel Groundhog Day revisiting of what we have just been through. First, the federal deficit is not ballooning. It is dramatically falling. As the economy has been recovering, tax revenues flowing to the federal government have increased, and the emergency economic stimulus programs have ramped down. As a result, the deficit has declined dramatically to less than half of what it was at the peak of the Great Recession. Federal spending is supposed to increase in support of household spending and American businesses during the worst of an economic downturn. And then, as unemployment declines and payrolls rise again, federal spending and the deficit decline. Such counter-cyclical federal spending help stabilize the economy across the inevitable business cycles. Second, the temporary spike in the federal deficit during the Great Recession did not undermine the strength of the dollar. Inflation has been low, and the dollar has increasingly been the preferred currency that the rest of the world uses to store its wealth. From the point of view of the rest of the world, the dollar is the most reliable currency available. Gold prices have been tumbling compared to the dollar. Third, the federal deficit is not some horrible burden on future generations. During World War II, the federal government ran up huge deficits compared to the size of the U.S. economy at the time to fund that war effort. The years following the war were years of expanding prosperity. Does anyone remember the generations following the war complaining of the horrible burden on them and their children of paying off the financial cost of financing World War II? The costs of lives lost and veterans crippled were real, but the deficit that financed that victory did not burden future generations. That is because when the federal government borrows, all it promises is that it will return those dollars with the promised interest at some future date. But it is the federal government that creates those dollars in the first place. It cannot run out of them. Of course, if it creates too many dollars, inflation will undermine the value of the dollar. But runaway inflation certainly does not threaten now and hasn't burdened the economy over the last several decades. The worry during the Great Recession and the slow recovery have been that deflation, falling prices, were threatening the economy, not inflation. Fourth, the size of the federal deficit has to be judged against the size of the overall economy. Currently, the deficit is at about the same level as a percentage of the total economy as it was during the Reagan and George W. Bush administrations. As the deficit grew during those years when Republicans were in power, Republicans preached that deficits were not really much of an economic problem. Apparently, it is only similarly sized deficits relative to the overall economy during Democratic administrations that matter. That suggests that the relative size of the deficit is a political football, not an economic problem. As a percentage of the annual economic output of the economy, bipartisan estimates of future federal deficits indicate that they will shrink to only about a fifth of what they were at the peak of the Great Recession in the last year of the Bush administration and the first year of the Obama administration. Normal growth in the U.S. economy will reduce the deficit to levels not seen since President Clinton balanced the budget in his last term in office. Europe has proved that austerity programs aimed at ruthlessly cutting government spending during a fragile economic recovery simply undermines household and business spending, sabotaging economic vitality and plunging the economy back into stagnation or recession. It is not public spending that threatens American economic vitality. It is underspending on repairing and replacing the public infrastructure that supports private economic activity and prosperity. The right-wing Tea Party fringe will again try to blackmail us into shooting ourselves in the foot rather than rebuilding a productive and sustainable economy that shares prosperity more equitably among all of our citizens. We need to be ready, once again, to voice an emphatic no to that minority's angry, economically destructive political antics.
Tom Power is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow morning at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.